Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 15th, 2005. Today's session is entitled City of God, Where We Live and God's Creation, Why Do We Build What We Build? Presented by Will Schroer, session number SCW-2005-01. Let's listen in.
He starts the tape.
I was thinking more like, I mean, not that I need it, I just want to go by the book.
You introduce yourself however you'd like,
okay,
and then start off with your material however
okay
you'd like,
okay,
and we'll be interested and attentive.
To the extent that you like.
To the extent that we like.
Okay, Linnea, are mom and dad like moments away or probably?
They're not coming there, they're watching it.
Oh, okay, fine. Well, very good. Okay, Burnett Antonio. Okay, good. Thank you all so much for coming. That's green. Wasn't intentional, but okay. My name is Will Schroer, and the title for the series that I'm going to do together with you is, and I just came up with this morning, so we can debate even the efficacy of the title. the printed title is "City of God?" What I'd like to do is work on a city blank God, and we can talk about what the appropriate thing to fill in the middle is. Is it city of God, city against God, city for God? What is the relationship between cities as we currently, the idea of the city, the cities that we currently have, the cities that we would like to have, and the relationship between all those things and the Christianity that hopefully we're trying to work on. So I'm looking forward a great deal to that conversation. I am a consultant during the day, anyway, and typically when I give these kinds of talks, of course, the traditional thing is to say, you know, what my affiliation is, you know, what are my credentials, basically, for talking about this sort of thing. And I'm happy to tell you, because I think that I bring some baggage, and you should know what that is. I run the practice at this large consulting firm called ICF Consulting that works on these sorts of issues. These sorts of issues being transportation and land use and how they work together. ICF stands for, it doesn't stand for it's a consulting firm, although it may as well. What it stands for is the Inner City Fund, and about 30 years ago it was started as a community development organization. And the folks did some for-profit consulting on the side to pay some bills, and that part took off, and the community development part, the nonprofit part, not so much. So anyway, we're now about, I don't know, last count, 1,600 people, and we have offices all over the place. And I think Chris was telling me he enjoyed the description of the firm as being mostly well-intentioned in my bio. And I think we're engaged in an ongoing experiment to see if anything that large and that for-profit can also be a good thing. And I'm open to the possibility of this, but it's ongoing debate, I think. Anyway, I have a couple of degrees, which I'm happy to tell you what they are, but my goal for this week is actually to downplay that part of it and to suggest that the real qualifications that one should have to talk about these things and to engage in debate about them are qualifications that we all have. That one, and I don't mean that you have to be a Christian to talk about these things, but we are, and that's what we should bring to this discussion. My other qualifications are, I've made certain promises, which I'm attempting to keep in the lines of being a husband, a father, and a citizen. And to the extent that you want to keep, you want to be those things as well, and as far as I'm concerned, those are all the qualifications you need to have to participate in this debate, and it's a good thing because those are the only people that we have to participate in this debate, okay? These are our cities, and it'll be one of my contentions that having left it to the quote-unquote experts is one of the things that's gotten us into trouble so far. Now, I'm going to try and do a lot of things in the course of the week, and I understand that not everyone's going to come to each session, and that's not just fine, it's great. So I'm going to try and do things in a standalone fashion. One of the questions that I want to sort of hover over everything, and which I'm not going to treat explicitly, except for the next 5 minutes, is taking off on the theme a little bit, is Is Christianity pro or anti-place? And specifically, is Christianity pro or anti-city? And I'm just going to read two things here to sort of frame that question, because I think it bears a lot of thinking about, and I think it has something to say about how we got to where we are. The first is, and this segues nicely into my waving of the books, which I am supposed to do as well. This is one of the books which is in the bookstore, and I commend it to you. I think it's a fantastic book called Sidewalks in the Kingdom. And the foreword is by Eugene Peterson, whom some of you may know from his translations. So Peterson opens his foreword saying, "In the Christian imagination, where you live gets equal billing with what you believe. Geography and theology are biblical bedfellows. Everything that the Creator God does, and therefore everything that we do, since we are His creatures and can hardly do anything in any other way, is in place. All living is local. This land, this neighborhood, these trees and streets and houses, this work, these shops and markets." Peterson goes on to argue that God is very, very interested in place. And I think that the theme for this week argues that as well. The burning bush was in a place. God chose a place to start his revelation. And as Peterson says, everything that has happened since has happened in a particular place and has made that place in part sacred. The response, I think, to that view of things is that God did not choose that place. God chose that person. And he was interested in that person. And where that person was, that's what God was really interested in. God was not so much interested in the place. And that tradition has a long history in Christianity as well. And now I'm going to read from a book which is not in the bookstore, but which I also commend to you, called The Conscience of the Eye. And opens up quoting Harvey Cox. "When the ark was finally captured by the Philistines, the Hebrews began to realize that Yahweh was not localized even in it. He traveled with his people and elsewhere. Yahweh was a god of time rather than place." And skipping around here, he quotes from some anonymous writer of the Epistle to Diognetus at the height of the Roman Empire's glory, who said, "Christians are not distinguished from the rest of humanity, either in locality or in speech or in customs, for they do not dwell off of cities in their own, nor do they practice an extraordinary style of life. They dwell in their own countries, but only as sojourners. Every foreign country is a fatherland to them, and every fatherland is a foreign country." He then quotes from Augustine and the City of God, who distinguishes between Cain, who built the city, and Abel, who did not, and makes it back then to our original point that God, that Christians engage in a pilgrimage through time rather than settling in place, drawing their authority from Jesus' refusal to allow his disciples to build monuments to him and his promise to destroy the Temple of Jerusalem. Judeo-Christian culture is, at its very roots, about experiences of spiritual dislocation and homelessness. Our faith began at odds with place. So, God is either choosing a place to work with us in and cares about that place and our relationship to that place, or he doesn't. He's more interested in us wherever we are, and if we move, he moves, and the place is just a backdrop and is not really all that important. Now, there's any number of nuances to that question, of course, and one of the interesting things that this book does in its opening is walk through the changing view in the Old Testament of cities. Cities were originally very bad. They were places of sin. God forbid that you should go to a city. You encountered God in the wilderness. Later they became places of where you encountered God in the city. And what is in the go through all of time and at the end of Revelation, what does God promise to do? To bring us a new city. Right, the city of Jerusalem, the new Jerusalem will come. Not the new wilderness, not the new country, but the new city will be where the new kingdom is centered. Jacobson has some nice things to say about that as well. So I'm certainly not a theologian, although Pam has promised when she's not taking care of the kids to pop in with theological observations. But I want to, this is my sort of, it's two things. It's an effort to link my slightly more prosaic observations with the more theological theme of the week. But I also feel very strongly that these guys are onto something, that Western Christians in particular, even if they haven't thought about it explicitly, are susceptible to the strains in our tradition which say city bad. And you've got to leave the city to encounter God. And you know, maybe we'll go to the city to mission there, or to witness there, or we'll go to the city because we're obeying the, you know, Matthew's commandment to do unto the least of these. But you know, given our druthers, you know, we wouldn't go there, and we wouldn't live there, and we wouldn't work there, and we'd do something else. I'm sympathetic to that. You know, my work is about the city. I live in the city, but I'm deeply sympathetic to the desire to get the heck out and to leave some of its problems behind. So I suggest this to you as a theme to keep in mind as we get into a couple of the more nitty-gritty kinds of, you know, zoning policy, which, you know, may or may not have anything to do with the Bible. I suggest that it does, but just keep that in mind. Why don't we stop there? Do we want to discuss that big question at all before we dive into the more... Well, keep it in mind.
Can I just throw one thing in here?
Please do.
Theologically, I don't know that Christianity is always anti-city or like wanting to be the Christian is against it. Because if you go, there's St. Augustine and the City of God and the whole community piece that also gets played out in some writers in the mid-20th century, including one really weird one, Charles Williams, who was a friend of C.S. Lewis, who saw the city as the holy community, that the perfect city would be the whole full community of the love of God exhibited in people. So I think there's a positive part in the tradition.
No, absolutely, absolutely. Thanks for adding that in. All right, last piece of intro material, I hope. What I'm going to try to do is, today we're going to talk about why we build what we build. Then on Tuesday, I'm going to try to look specifically at the relationships underlying city design. Cities are the result of people trying to get together, and they also force people to get together. So some people come to the city because they want to be with other people, and other people are forced to be with other people because they are in the city, and it goes both ways. So we're going to talk about cities and relationships, and not just between two people, but between the rest of creation and, we hope, God. On Wednesday, I get to really get into the wonkiness. I have a degree in public policy, and the school that gave me that degree was mostly about economics, so what it really means is I have a master's in economics, and so I'm going to spend that day talking about that. And when I have these conversations with people, a lot of times the discussion comes down to, well, isn't what we have really just more efficient, and isn't that why we do it? And I didn't want to load the bookstore down with too many books that probably wouldn't sell. But on Wednesday, I'm going to talk mostly out of this book called If You're So Smart, The Narrative of Economic Expertise. And his thesis is that economists basically just tell stories. And I think he's exactly right. And so we're going to talk about storytelling, economists that tell stories, and how you should listen to people who are trying to tell you economics stories. We'll talk about that specifically with, well, you know, land prices in the cities and why do people do what they do around city economics. But I'm going to go a little bigger than that and talk about economists generally and storytelling. And then Thursday we're going to talk about children in cities. And then on Friday, we're hopefully going to talk about options before Friday, but on Friday we'll focus specifically on, you know, what then should we do, where should we live, and how should we live. So I hope that you can make it to, you know, several of those, but if you can't, there are the books, of course, and I'm happy to chat with people, you know, at any time, and off we go. Okay. All right, the intros being over, let's jump into the good stuff here. What I'd like to do is I'm going to throw a bunch of slides up. They're all going to be green, apparently, because I don't know why. But what I'd like to do is if we can pass around, we have a pile of pencils, and if you can just rip half of a piece of this recycled paper off, you're really just going to need half a piece. You probably need the whole half piece of this, and there's no smaller than that.
I'll give you some color this morning.
Is that going to be enough paper? This is turning out to be more popular than I anticipated, right? Just a half sheet.
Does everyone have something? Who needs something to write with?
Yeah.
I have a lot more paper, too.
Generating some right here. Thank you.
Hi,
Joe. Just take the compost pile when you're done.
It's too hard to dispose of.
Okay, are we good? All right, now the goal here is not to overthink this stuff. I really just want you to rate it on a scale of I like it or I don't like it. Not, you know, applying any other screen, intellectual, theological, economic, than anything else. Just I like it or I don't like it. So I'm going to give you about, you know, 15 seconds really in each one. And a high score is good, so 5 is better.
Okay, here's a couple of pens. Someone else need something to write with?
Okay, is that long enough for everyone?
Yep.
Good.
Which is higher, 5 or 1?
5 is good.
3 is neutral, 1 is negative.
Right. You know, and if you want to fine tune it with a 2 or a 4, that's good too. Are people numbering your responses? That's not
putting them in order.
Like that.
Now renting.
Now rent. No rent.
Are you trying to influence us with the weather?
There's all kinds of ways that I can. Green light is tested to be especially negative.
Fortunately, got a lot of Minnesotans here this week. Okay, everybody good?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Get a couple of scores. Shout them out.
Four.
Five.
And some twos and threes. Okay. I'm going to give it all away now. Two.
Three.
I'm going to exercise the prerogative of the chair. And okay, three.
Four.
Okay, a little slower.
Two.
Love it or hate it, I guess.
Yeah, this is all over the place. I'm going to do like this for that one. Okay, four.
One.
All right. Five.
Three.
I heard one, two, but mostly three to five. Mm-hmm. Is that fair?
Yeah. Okay.
I don't want to skew anything here. Six.
One.
Maybe four. Okay, mostly on the one to three. Seven.
Four.
Two. Five.
Four.
Two.
Three.
One.
Three. Four.
Well, I can see what we're going to be doing for the rest of the day. We're just going to have to go by each slide and discuss it all.
I'm doing another back and forth.
All right. Eight?
One.
I got to throw that one up and see which one that was. Nine?
Four.
Three.
Four.
Okay. Ten?
One.
All right. 11.
Five.
Five.
Four.
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 Three.
Four.
Five.
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 We should
do
one of 3 to 5. All right. 12.
One.
Four. Four, man.
I'm going to give it to them. I'll just throw one little three, but mostly one. All right. 13.
One.
Three.
Four.
Two.
Four.
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 Three.
Four.
Four.
Five.
Three.
Four.
But I hear some ones and twos, though?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's another 1 to 5, all right. Yeah, I'm going to run a straight democracy here. Okay, 14.
One.
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 Two.
Two.
One.
Three.
Okay.
Fifteen.
One.
Five.
Four.
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 Five. Four. This is why you don't build the city on a committee.
Yeah.
Well.
That's why the experts
have
a
16.
2.
1.
1. 1.
3.
3.
3.
3. I get to get all the people who agree together.
Yeah, how many people say 5?
That's why you have different suburbs.
Okay.
Some people get to live in Detroit, some people get to live in Portland.
I didn't know
anybody
who
live in Detroit.
Okay,
17. 2.
3.
3.
3.
4.
4.
4.
4.
5.
5.
5. 5.
5.
1.
1.
I got a crabby toward the end.
Yeah, 18.
1 to 3.
Stop me if I'm mischaracterizing what the, you know, vox populi is saying here. 19?
5.
1.
1.
1.
4.
4. 4.
3.
Wow. Well, no twos anyway. Another 1, 2, 3, and 5. 20.
5, 5
2,
3,
4,
3,
4,
2,
4. Do that again.
2,
5,
5
2,
4,
3.
I
can't.
3.
I think it was 2 to 4.
21. We're almost done.
3.
4. 4.
4.
4.
4.
4.
4.
9.
4.
What number is this?
21. 3. 4. 3. 3. Mostly 3 to 5 on that one. Okay.
22?
2.
4.
2.
4.
4.
5.
I said,
wait,
2.
2.
One more time.
2.
4.
4.
3.
5.
2. I'm going to call that a hard to say. 23?
4.
3.
4.
4.
4 to 5. All right, that's good.
3.
23. Okay.
2 to 3.
Think fairer. And 25, I think, is the last one.
24.
24.
Day before Christmas.
One.
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 1.
2.
3.
1 to 3. Okay, and was there one more?
Yeah.
4.
5.
5.
5.
3.
Those were the two seminary slides, one
yeah.
without the
yeah.
color.
Yeah. Okay.
One of the
well,
Tijuana and one of the
I would propose the following lessons from these ratings. First of all is, well, first I'll confess that the odd numbers are not only one kind of design, but more like one kind of design than another. And the even numbers were more like each, you know, it's different classes, right? So kind of alternate. So there's in no way universal agreement that, you know, one kind is horribly terrible and the other kind is fantastically good. But I will propose that in general, this kind of design scores higher, more 3s to 5s, not that there aren't any 1s or 2s, but more 3s to 5s. And this kind of design is more kind of down toward the not so wild about it, more 1s and 2s, although, you know, some 5s too, the occasional 5. Some 4s, a lot of 3s. Neutral anyway, in some cases, okay? Now, what are these two kinds of, would somebody propose a different reading of those scores?
Well, I will see, you know, on what basis you're saying there are two designs here. Maybe that's behind it all, but I don't see that right off the bat.
Okay.
There might have been various aspects that we're responding to.
No, absolutely.
What I saw were people-oriented designs,
yeah.
Community squares, places for children, places for interaction, and then I saw industrial commercial designs with flat concrete walls, wide open boulevards, no sidewalks, mm-hmm. no cafes. I mean, even had the same cityscape a couple times with and without the people on it. Higher score if the people are having a good time.
Yeah,
exactly. Communal
and the time of the season.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, boulevard is the mountains probably looks prettier in July than January for some people.
Right, right. Okay, good. Well, there's no, there's a there are any number of these exercises running around. I kind of just cobbled that one together. And one can use these sorts of things, of course, to make various points. I will propose the following points. That what people tend to respond well to are these sorts of things. Not exclusively, but again, generally speaking. You caught that the last two slides were the same place, but and the first one being the way it looks today, and the second one being how it could look if one did various things to it. And the doing various things to it actions are what people kind of like. They like seeing people, and people like to see other people. People tend to congregate where other people already are. And what gets people someplace so that there are people to have a critical mass to begin with, it has to, there are certain design aspects that get people downtown. Maybe you weren't, most of the pictures didn't have any kind of different transit in it, so it's a bit much to extrapolate from these scores that people tend to like places with transit. But certainly the pictures that I threw up juxtaposed mixed use and compact development with against single use and not compact, or what people typically call sprawl development. People like trees, people don't like the absence of trees. Although you may not have been explicitly evaluating the pictures for, you know, bike lanes or not bike lanes, places that are friendly to things other than cars look different than things that are not friendly to cars, to things other than cars, and those tend to score higher.
I would submit that that bike lane is not too bicycle friendly.
Well, that's a fair point. Yeah, no, that's a fair point.
We come from a new city.
Uh-huh.
6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Incorporated.
Okay.
City Council had a very clear plan in mind. And the assumption was people want to just drive up to a store, go in and get what they want, and go out. Horrible. We got a bunch of strip malls. And in contrast to that, Sharon Parks had a presentation up here at a conference where she talked about the commons, which is like what you described in the first picture.
Mm-hmm.
Where people gather, people share, and we talked about what the commons had been for us.
Mm-hmm.
It was wide variety. I mean, the architecture, you know, things mm-hmm. are important,
yeah.
but it was a place to gather, a place to see people.
Exactly.
Meet mm-hmm. other things.
Yeah.
Exactly. Town square concept.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, I think the philosophy is the most important thing in a city is shopping. Is what
they were saying.
That kind of street.
Yeah.
You come to Lakewood and you can take some of those number one pictures.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
And it was just built in the last 6 years?
Huh?
It was just built in the last 6 years?
No, but I mean anything that's gone in, and the assumption was people just want to drive up, get their stuff, get out, and go.
So yeah. It was designed as a giant strip mall.
Huh?
A
strip mall
concept.
Yes, was
and then had all this area.
When did all that building take place?
Within the last 6 years.
And where is it in the country?
It's south of Tacoma, Washington. And you know, it was like they had this incredible opportunity.
Almost no bike lanes.
You should know better. There's no excuse for that.
No, not anymore.
I'll tell you.
What people typically do not respond well to, what makes them not feel good, are a particular combination of any one number of these things sort of on their own may or may not be so bad or good, but in combination, especially wide streets, only cars, lots of utilities overhead, very low density, single use, low density particularly, And the narrow sidewalks, which tell people that they're not really very welcome.
And no trees.
Sorry?
And no
trees, exactly.
Seminary Street, get on both pictures.
Yeah.
It's the same place, and this is what it looks like today. And then if you go back...
Look at the tower in the middle.
There's the tower in the middle, exactly.
Kind of
and so the,
or whatever.
And the, there's a firm called... I'm sure, what did you
Urban
say?
Urban Nist.
No, what did you say your name was?
Oh, Suzanne
here was immediately recognized it. She's a city planner, and said, "Oh, that's from Urban Advantage, and there's a firm that does just this sort of thing, which takes pictures of people." You know, a lot of this exercise has been done any number of times, and one of the responses to it is, "Well, sure, that works in X place, but you could never do that here, for example, on Seminary Avenue. You could never make Seminary Avenue look good. We better just move on." And one of the things that Urban Advantage does is they're not just, they're the uber Photoshop pros, but they're also very smart about urban design. And they can turn the picture of Seminary Avenue into, over time, and there's an intermediate picture here, which I can also show you, what could you do over time to improve Seminary Avenue so that it would be an attractive economically viable place. And this is not a fantasy. All of these things can be done, have been done elsewhere on places like this Seminary Avenue. And so Urban Advantage goes around and sort of collects these things. And then
where's the power line put under?
They put it underground.
Light rail?
Yeah, you can do that too.
You can't see it though.
Yeah. So that's the, that was whoever pointed out that it was the same Seminary Avenue. It's the same exact place. And it's down in the distance. Now, the suggestion, oh, there's the intermediate picture of what you can do in the meantime.
Let's see
Let me see if I can get the intermediate picture back here, just a second.
It kind of flashed by a couple times.
There it is. So, what have we not done? We haven't had time to put in trees yet. We haven't put a streetcar in yet. All we've basically done at this point is we've broken up the street a little bit by putting in this sort of median, which helps a little bit. It's not the greatest thing in the world, but it's not the worst thing either. The sidewalks are still narrow, but people feel a little bit more welcome. Probably we haven't managed to widen the sidewalks yet, but there's a little bit more of a sense of enclosure here. There's a sense that it's a little bit more of an outdoor room. And people like to feel a little bit of a sense of enclosure, and that they're in a room even though they're outdoors. And there's, there's sort of an art/science to, well, what's the relationship between the width of the buildings and the width of the street, such that you feel that sense of protective enclosure and you feel comfortable, like, I'm going to walk around down here and kind of hang out down here a little bit. And this is actually doing okay. And so they've changed the zoning to allow 4 stories here because that's the right. The street was so wide to begin with, you needed 4 stories to provide that comfortable sense of enclosure. And if it had been narrower, you just would need 2 stories. And so that's the intermediate. And there's no reason why that can't be done on this particular street. Okay. Well, my conclusion is, if you look back at the scores, and here I promised to quote Paul in my little promo, so I'm going to do it. But, I do this quite a bit, and other people do it way more than I do. And, there are people that this is really all that they do. They kind of go around, and people are like, well, we have to do it this way. And then, besides, we like it this way. And then you throw up a bunch of pictures and ask people to score them. And it turns out that that's not actually what, on average, people like. People really like not the kind of sprawly, wide streets, they like the more dense, compact, outdoor rooms, community-oriented, whatever kind of name you want to put to it. And then the conversation starts, well, if that's what we like, why are we building all this other stuff? Why are we spending all this money building this stuff that doesn't make us feel good, right? Which is why I asked you to rate it not on a screen of, is it efficient, or do you think it works, or, but do I like it? Does it make me feel good? And the bottom line is that those kinds of built environments is the technical term, which encompasses both the buildings and the streets around them, do not make people feel good. And the other kind does. And if these things do not make us feel good, why are we spending all this money and time building? And that is, I think it's a question which I don't suggest that Paul was talking explicitly about that phenomenon, obviously, but I think his question was a very broad one, and I think it encompasses this. And what I'd like to do is spend the rest of the time talking a little bit about that. And I'm going to propose three reasons. I'm not going to leave you with a big pile of public policy numbers, you know, this bill spent so much money, et cetera. But what if you want those things, I can tell you where to find them, where you can find. But the answer is really, I think, comes down to three parts. The first is there's an unbelievable amount of money, not just to build, that you can only spend on roads, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but to me, the particularly bad thing is that you can only spend them on certain kinds of roads. And that if you were going to build a certain kind of road, like this one, then there's an almost unlimited amount of money to do that with. And if you want to build any other kind of road, A, it's going to be hard to get the money for it, and B, it's going to be very difficult once you have the money to get the permits to do it in a different way than this way.
And it has to do with federal funding or what?
It's a combination of federal funding rules and what has become the standard in the engineering, in the transportation engineering profession, which is why it's a two-part problem. Even if you can get the money to do something differently, the engineers will tell you, well, that is not standard, and so we don't want to do it because our professional code won't let us do something non-standard.
Well, could you give an example of that?
I certainly can.
Yeah.
I'm going to give a couple, if you don't mind, and I'll give a road example and a non-road example. Mm-hmm. In the federal funding process, there's one path for roads and another path for almost everything else. And the feds give all the road money more or less to the states and attach certain rules to it. And if you follow those rules, and they're not straightforward, but they're understood, and you know, the process kind of flows. And if you do all that, then the state and then the city can build X road or X highway, et cetera. If you want, however, to spend any federal transportation money on, say, a transit system, buy more buses, extend your light rail system, there's not a specific path that you go through. You have to go to your congressman and say, I would like to extend our light rail system. The congressman has to go through this whole sort of special process to get that into the transportation bill, to have Federal Transit Administration rate your proposal as being a good idea or not. You know, Federal Transit Administration comes to your town and rates your proposal for, you know, well, transit needs dense development around it to support it, because put a transit system in the middle of nowhere and it doesn't make so much sense, right? You know, are you putting it in a corridor with a lot of people that are going to ride it? Now, all of this is arguably, you know, it didn't come out of nowhere. It was a response to a number of situations, one of which was the feds used to give transit money without doing any of those things, and it was a pounding waste because people built transit systems in dumb places. The bottom line is you have to go through this much, 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 much longer process to get transit money than you do to get road money. And, you know, your congressman isn't involved in getting you road money. If you want a special road project that's just fantastically expensive, then you go to, you know, then of course politics kicks in. But for your garden variety, we want to make this 2-lane road a 4-lane road or a 6-lane road or whatever, you know. There's no what we would call large-scale politics involved. It just kind of runs through the highway department, and if it meets certain criteria, you know, it's jammed up most of the time, then it gets the money. And you know, you don't have to do a bunch of coalition building, and there aren't activists out saying, you know, please sign the petition to get, you know, X interchange. You've never seen anyone doing that, right? because they don't need to. It just kind of runs through the state highway department. And then again, in contrast to, you know, a new rail system or you know, new buses even, people are always out doing fundraising for, you know, join our activist campaign to get more money for the bus system, or, you know, et cetera, because it's a completely different process and it's much more difficult. A sort of more nitty-gritty example would be, I'm going to fire up this example here, just because it's a prime one. I have to see where it is. I'll just go back. Now, yeah?
What is that?
This is the...
It's like New Jersey or Texas.
The beginning of the subdevelopment?
Yes, it is. That's exactly what it's right. And so a very, very large developer owned all this land. They would like to develop it over time. They put in the roads first for any number of reasons, some good, some bad. Anyway, they're not 100% sure what they're going to do with this land, right? They're not sure what the market is going to want over time, right? So, you know, I look at this and I'm like, well, if you don't, different uses demand different kinds of roads, right? And regardless of how you feel about this whole subject, I think almost anybody can agree on that. But the code only allows them to build this road, okay? And so they're like, well, if we can only ever build this road anyway, regardless of what the uses are, let's just go ahead and build it. And so when we were trying to sell this land to various people, we can show them we've already improved, you know, the roads. All you have to do is come in and build. You can go to town. So the state highway code says it's got to be this wide. You're going to have one traffic lane and one parking lane, both of which are, I think in this case, 16 feet wide, which is kind of absurd from my perspective, but that's what the code says. You got to have a certain width sidewalk. It's a little cheaper to build it next to the road rather than kind of off. The bottom line is that this was the only road that was allowable by the, I mean, you could have built it even wider. This is the smallest road they could build under the current code. And if you wanted to build something narrower, if you really thought that this was going to end up being, you know, dense housing or shops or something, what you really wanted is narrow road, you would have had to propose, you know, same thing. When you want to build something different, you got to go ask for a variance. You got to justify why it needs to be different, why it's not going to be more dangerous. You know, the theory is that the 16-foot, if you're driving a 12-foot car in a 16-foot lane, you're never going to hit anybody. Statistically, that turns out to be 180 degrees wrong. The narrower the road, the safer it is because you're going to go slower. Yes.
And that's exactly the rationale where we live, where they've been narrowing the roads.
Yeah.
So we have two examples where the roads have been narrowed recently on major construction
activities.
Where is
that? Where?
New Hampshire.
In New Hampshire and in Vermont.
Good for you. They drive fast in Ireland even though the roads are very small.
Well, it's not a fail-safe relationship by any stretch. But that's my answer to your question, where can I give an example? And this is, you know, there's no reason to build a wide road here because there's no demand whatsoever, but that's what the code calls for. Yeah.
As a bicyclist, though, on a wide road, I have somewhere to go.
Yeah.
On a narrow road, I go.
Good point. All of these subjects have little sub debates. by which I mean to say yes to your point, not to say no to my
hand. It is interesting. In some areas of Seattle, they've taken roads that were, parking on both sides in four lanes, cut down to one lane in each direction and a left turn lane, and it did not slow up traffic. If anything, it improved it.
Oh, absolutely.
People were jockeying for those two lanes.
Right. Now, one of the interesting sort of sub-debates here is, from an engineering perspective, the wider the thing, in this case the road, but you can also substitute the pipe, the whatever, the more stuff you can put through it. And one of the interesting, because people are not, water or oil or anything else that you would put through a facility, there's a psychology that comes into play, and in a lot of cases, if you design things right, you can put more people through a narrower facility. And there's any number of reasons why that might be, but the bottom line is, and we can talk about them, but empirically that turns out to be the case, that you can narrow roads and put more people through them than otherwise. And not just because fewer people drive, you can put more cars through. Anyway, yes?
And so then the typical thing that you see is that everybody thinks it's a no-brainer to widen a road, thinking we already have a lot of traffic congestion, we need to widen the road, and so it's counterintuitive to what most people's assumption is, to convince them that the narrower road. Mm. But I heard Walter Kulosh speak a few years ago, and his line was, he's a traffic engineer, that widening a road is just like getting a larger belt instead of going in a tie.
Yes.
It's just you can keep on getting a bigger and bigger and bigger belt, but the wider you make it, the wider you'll need to make it in the future. It's never going to address the problem.
Mm-hmm. We just have the hour for this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so let me propose the other two things I wanted to say here, and then we can kind of bring it home. I don't have a special picture for this, but because I just showed 30 of them or whatever, but most of the compact stuff, the dense community-oriented, whatever you want to call it, stuff that I showed, is either strata illegal or needs a special variance to be built. Whereas the single use, single thing, whether it's house, business, whatever, on its own plot of land, can be built and developed, the technical term is, of right. I own this thing, I can put X on it, where if X is a single use, house, business, whatever, and I'm in a housing zone or I'm in a business zone, et cetera. And it's, in most parts of the country, this is changing, fortunately, but in most parts of the country, it is illegal to build the kinds of nice things that people rate highly on these pictures or spend a lot of money to go vacation in, because, and why is that? The short history of zoning is that back in the day, before there was zoning, you could build, say, a tannery right next to an apartment building. And tanneries back in the day were very dirty, dangerous, et cetera, things. And people thought that that was a bad idea. Now, that telescopes a vast debate in planning, obviously, and it wasn't just tanneries, it was, vast tenements and, quote unquote, overcrowding and disease, when a lot of people are close together, disease spreads more quickly. And, sometimes we forget that those days of kind of disease-ridden slums are not that long ago, actually, right? Now, did the crowding cause the disease, et cetera? These are interesting debates in planning history. The bottom line was there was a time when it was thought that the solution to all these problems was to separate uses. Well, the people over here will have the businesses over here, we'll have the recreation over here. They won't interfere with each other. Each will be better to more fully pursue its, another technical term in planning, highest and best use. Once the Supreme Court gave its stamp of approval to planners being able to tell owners of properties, yes, you can or cannot build X here, which was a big fight because Americans being who they are, they wanted to say, this is my property, I want to do what I want with it, right? But in the decision Euclid, which was the city in Ohio, you can probably describe this more fully than I can. But anyway, the Supreme Court in Euclid said, zoning that puts X use here and X use there is completely consistent with the Constitution. It's good for the common good, right? Once you could separate the tannery and the apartment building, then it was a short step to separating the apartment buildings from the single-family homes and the not-so-expensive single-family homes from the expensive single-family homes, all under the guise of we're doing the best thing for the city because, the single-family homes should really all be by themselves and that's good for them and et cetera. And now basically planners and zoners can put anybody any place they want, and they do. And much like the engineers, sort of a code that gets built up and that's the way to do it, and there's not really a lot of thought about, does this make sense anymore? Are tanneries still dangerous? Is it really such a bad thing to have a business, maybe not a tannery, but a coffee shop, next to a house? Or a small grocery store so you can go get milk next to a house? All of which is a very long way of kind of telescoping the story of why can we no longer build, apartments over a convenience store. Well, we can't because in 99, percent of the places around the country, it's illegal. Not because the citizens in that town decided that that was a bad idea, but just because that's the standard professional practice now, is to outlaw those things unless somebody asks for permission otherwise.
They're required.
Mm-hmm. Now we're getting it so it's required. Now we're kind of, it's coming full circle. If you want to build here, it has to be mixed use. That's right. That's exactly right. Let me finish proposing my three reasons why we don't build things that we like anymore. So the second reason is that because it's illegal in a lot of places. And the third is because parking drives a tremendous amount of design. And this is sort of a related to but distinct from part of zoning. And most zoning codes require that you supply adequate parking with your development. Now, what is adequate? As it turns out to be just a huge amount relative to what actually gets used over time. One of the standard rules of thumb for retail is that you have to provide a parking space for everybody who's going to be there on the day after Thanksgiving. Okay, and you know, the rest of the year, it's just empty, right? But that's the law. You gotta provide, you gotta build that parking, okay? And you have to give it away. Now, in some cases, there's a law that you can't charge for it because that will drive people onto the street, and we don't want people parking on the street because, you know, it'll clog it up. In most cases, it's just the retailer's preference. We don't want to charge for parking because, you know, we want to bring people in, and if we charge, they'll go someplace else. That's kind of a race to the bottom. Anyway, the law says that you got to build piles of parking, then people don't charge for it at you know, retail destinations, and at work, ditto, you have to build a lot of parking for your employees, and ditto, nobody charges for it. And so the bottom line is that there's this sea of free parking out there, and now that my economist side kicks in, and I'll just ask you, when somebody is giving away fantastic amounts of free stuff, what happens to it?
You use it.
You absolutely use it. As a friend of mine was fond of saying, if pizza were free, there would never be enough pizza, right? People use it with abandon, and as soon as you start charging just a little bit for it, its use goes way down. But in a lot of cases, we don't do that.
In some cities, they charge a huge amount for it. You pay $20 to $30 a day to park in many cities.
No, that's true. And I'm sorry?
You really talk more about sprawl and new development.
I am, but I'm also talking about parking downtown, and the reason that people can charge that much for parking and get people to pay it is that they don't have any choice. That's where the job is, and so, and you know, the transit system sucks, so you gotta drive.
Well, that is a problem. People are, that's about the one thing that pushes people towards transit.
Yeah, no, that's
true. Is it cost of parking?
Yes.
That's about the only thing.
Right.
Will?
Yes.
There's a really double message or triple message when you dine at two down on 50th and France, mm-hmm. where there are parking ramps similar mm-hmm. to those, mm-hmm. and they're free.
Yes.
But I got a $25 parking ticket one day in the free ramp because it's 90 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I went to lunch and then decided to go to Talbot's. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that was an incredibly unfriendly message.
You got charged for trip chain.
Yeah, exactly.
You get charged for walking around. That's exactly right. Warren.
Well, you know, I forget the whole story, but Trivant in Minneapolis had parking for the employees. They didn't have enough.
Mm-hmm.
So they were dealing with the parking, and then they decided, we will give you, you know, $30 or $40 a month,
mm-hmm.
and you can pay for the parking or you do mm-hmm. anything else you want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They realized that then people were getting $40, mm-hmm. taking the bus, yeah. some were riding their bikes, and then they didn't have to build the extra parking lot
yeah.
because everybody was demanding it, and they said, no, you will pay for parking, but we'll give you the money. And then they didn't have to build it. Public transportation got used, bikes got used, and everything. And, you know, like, okay, how many companies do we need to do that before the lights go on?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a great story. And that's, it's an increasingly common one, but it takes selling to. Yes, Mary.
This may be a little stretch, but I heard one of the Kennedy brothers, who does a lot of environmental legal work,
mm-hmm.
say anytime you see a subsidy, you find a polluter.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you say there's really free parking, in some ways, you're subsidized parking, so you're going to see a polluted way of getting there and getting home again.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well said.
Just to throw out, you know, you had the example of day after Thanksgiving requirements. I mean, in many places, and this is older churches have often gotten around this, but in many places, churches are required to build enough parking for Easter mm-hmm. Sunday,
yeah.
you know, which we all know is not how many people come on the average Sunday. And I mean, our congregation is, we're out of code, and fortunately, I have a good will of a neighborhood that has said, that's okay, you don't need to build more parking because that would encroach upon a creek that people like. But
you need to share the parking with a business that's open during weekdays.
Well, that concludes my time. I'm happy to stay and chat. You know, I'm a little conflicted sort of when I talk about these things. On the one hand, there's so many interesting questions, and there really are details which matter. And I want to talk about all of those. On the other hand, it's at base really not that complicated, and I don't want to suggest otherwise. And I would like to leave you really, you know, with a simple message that the stuff that we like can be built. When it is built, it works, and people like it. We're not building more of it because we've made it very difficult to build more of it, and there's really an entrenched sort of, you know, way of doing things, which is, it's hard to get people to do something differently for any number of reasons, but it is doable. And so that's my sort of message of hope to end the day with, that people do like it, it is doable, it works when it's built, and it's very popular when you can bring everything together. But you have to solve the money, the zoning, and the parking all together.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. Good discussion.